last generation centrifuge. And it says it can industrialize these machines without any reliance outside the country. Also, mechanical tests began on the top-of-the-line IR-9 centrifuge that has a separative capacity of 50 SWU. Also, a unit to assemble and evaluate advanced centrifuges was launched in Natanz. And the second phase of industrial production of deuterium compounds was launched at the Arak Heavy Water Reactor facility. Iran has been enriching uranium to 60%, and that 60% enriched uranium has mounted to 25 kilograms, Iran recently announced. Looking at the oil tanker situation and how Iran acted upon it, would you say that this country can act as a role model for other countries? To what extent can it do so?
Well, following the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, we saw that discursive political and ideological branches of Iran's anti-imperialist viewpoint spread across the world, both in the immediate region and other geographical areas, including Latin America. But let's not forget that when these discourses are coupled with hard and military power, we definitely see it grow. Or, to use a better word, increasingly expand.
Apart from the world catching up, the US has also weakened itself by overreaching in its adventurism and venturing into not properly pre-planned wars. Actually, former President Trump had put Iran next on the possible hit list. From the American Civil War through the Korean War, US conflicts have mostly been paid for by taxes and war bonds. But in the post-September 11 era, U.S. military spending has almost entirely been financed by debt. It took $2.2 trillion to finance the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, according to figures from Brown University's Costs of War project. And that sum, which is roughly 10% of the country's total gross domestic product, GDP, only reflects upfront costs. By including the cost of interest, we'd be adding another $2.1 trillion by 2030. And through 2050, the interest alone should top $6.5 trillion, even if war spending had theoretically stopped in 2019. That's according to research published last year from Heidi Peltier, director of the 20 Years of War project at Boston University's Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future, CBS reports. Never mind the cost of war, there's domestic financial demands U.S. President Biden has to address at home. That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do join us again at the same times next week and each week after for more on tight spots and how to survive or get out of them, or anything else. Bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The result of the presidential polls in the Central American country of Nicaragua is yet another slap on the already badly disfigured face of the terrorist called the U.S. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Cajon International. This article is titled, Ortega Victory, Another Blow to U.S. Terrorists. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The result of the presidential polls in the Central American country of Nicaragua is yet another slap on the already badly disfigured face of the terrorist called the U.S. Washington has not stopped wailing following the victory of the incumbent, President Daniel Ortega, for whom as many as 76% of eligible voters cast their ballots in the November 7 elections. Amid terror threats and the same stale policy of illegal sanctions, thereby giving him a fourth consecutive five-year term. Ortega, a student leader since his teens in the early 1960s, who joined the then underground Sandinista National Liberation Front, FSLN, to actively participate in protests against the U.S.-installed dictatorship of Anastasio Somoza family that was finally ousted in 1979, has indeed transformed the face of Nicaragua. Ortega's revolutionary reforms has uplifted the social and economic conditions of the majority of the people, especially the indigenous population, much to the alarm of the white European minority of landholders and corporate dealers, who are the residue of the centuries-long Spanish occupation, had turned the country into a family fiefdom, serving the interests of the U.S. colonialism. This is the reason the U.S. regime is raving and ranting over the results of the recent election, even as Ortega recently hailed the people's mandate for his party as a victory over terrorists. He denounced the U.S. and its local agents as demons who don't want peace for our people and instead opt for slander and disqualifications. It should be noted that the U.S. had militarily occupied Nicaragua in 1909 as part of the so-called Banana Wars, and before withdrawing its military forces in 1933 had installed Anastasio Somoza Garcia, a wealthy plantation owner of Spanish extraction, as the dictator. Even ever since the end of the Somoza family dictatorship by the revolution led by the popular Sandinista forces, the U.S. has tried every trick up to its sleeve to re-establish its hegemony but failed. The North Americans, along with their neo-colonialist partners in the European Union, have imposed their cowardly sanctions on Ortega and his family members and allies, but to no avail. Nicaragua, which is allied with other progressive Latin American states such as Cuba and Venezuela, has continued its development project thanks to the cordial ties it enjoys with the free world, including Russia, China, and the Islamic Republic of Iran. Ortega, in a public address recently in the capital, Managua, to jubilant crowds derided the U.S. and the Europeans as Yankee imperialists and said the era of neocolonialism is long past. Nicaragua is the largest country of isthmus connecting North and South America. It is rich in raw materials and has extensive coastlines on both the Pacific Ocean and the Caribbean Sea, an arm of the Atlantic Ocean. if other Latin American states take the courageous step to support the demands of their people, U.S. hegemony over the region will certainly be a thing of the past.
We get people.
No win situation.
Nearly a year into the administration of President Joe Biden, the country's leader remains under immense pressure over a wide range of failures and broken promises. One main factor that could capture the spirit of Biden's performance are the national polls, which have shown a steady decline in his favorability among not just the undecided voters, but even liberals.
65% disapprove among this group. That's Kabul, that's Afghanistan. Same group now. Honest, 57% say, 57% say no.
57%
yeah.
said no, he's not honest.
On honesty, remember? I mean,
that's not his image when he walked into the White House.
He ran on that.
Yes,
Stuart.
He did.
Leadership skills, 63% say no. And a big one here on competency, is the administration competent? 62% say no. I would say those numbers are brutal. I've never worked in a White House.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll try to analyze how the Delaware senior politician has managed to address challenges facing the U.S. as a nation's leader, what his critics believe, and what his supporters' fears are. Thank you for joining us.
The 78-year-old Democrat has had to make hard decisions, some of which would have certainly proven to be catastrophic, such as the chaotic withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan, which led to a swift takeover of the country by Taliban. But it is not only the foreign policy. The president has to deal with nemesis at home as well.
Now, with liberals in power, not just in the White House, but also both chambers of the U.S. Congress, infighting has proven to be inevitable in cases such as his infrastructure initiative, which has dragged huge corporations into a power play. We're now joined by Garland Nixon, a radio talk show host and political analyst. Now, Mr. Nixon is also an outspoken civil libertarian and First Amendment advocate who currently serves on the National Board of Directors for the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, Mr. Nixon, the mess that we saw in Afghanistan, how has it affected Joe Biden personally and U.S. Democrats in general?
Well, I think one of the first things to keep in mind is that Joe Biden leads a wing of the Democratic Party that they base their ideology on technocracy. They're technocrats. So what they argue is that the system, and I mean this is, they don't, you know, outwardly argue this, but this is the foundation of their ideology. The system is fine, and as technocrats, we are better able to institute the system than any other party. So they come in and they argue competency. And so the failure in Afghanistan flies in the face of their argument that they are the more competent managers of this imperialist system. That's number one.
Thank you for joining us on the program, Mr. Nixon.
The senior politician from Delaware entered the presidential race under very critical conditions. The Democratic Party was facing the unprecedented challenge of Donald Trump's rise to power and his unconventional techniques to undermine opponents.
Democracy is in peril, and I think that, again, if you talk to the man or woman on the street here in America, there are a lot of people that don't have a lot of, confidence that we even live in a democracy.
A year after Biden's victory in the 2020 presidential election, U.S. democracy remains in danger, according to liberals, as Trump refuses to concede and plans to come back to address his defeat. Our next guest is an activist and political commentator who will help us understand the situation better with his perspective. Mr. Ramiro Fuentes, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Fuentes, the infighting we're seeing today between Democrats, it's obviously toxic. How is it impacting the nation's bills for infrastructure and taxes?
Biden's tax and spending proposal, Build Back Better, is a last-ditch effort to save capitalism. Capitalism is inherently unsustainable. It is built on contradiction. Capitalism has embedded within it excessive overconsumption, and the means of production, the wealth of society, is not owned by those who produce the wealth. But even though, for example, the United States, the wealthiest country in the world, there's enough houses to house everybody. There's enough food to feed everybody. Yet there's rising homelessness, there's rising hunger, there's rising unemployment, even though there's so many jobs that need to get done. It's inherently unstable because capitalism is not based on values.
Thank you for joining us on the program, Mr. Ramiro Fuentes.
With Trump's plans of shifting the power dynamics through the 2022 midterm elections, Biden is facing an ever-narrowing chance of winning a second term. Last time, the billionaire businessman used election fraud to overturn Biden's victory and even incite his supporters to storm the Capitol in an attempt to overturn the election results, yet to no avail.
The United States has always claimed to be a democracy, and in reality, it's been a capitalist republic. A republic is different from a democracy in the sense that in a republic, the real power of the state is wielded by those with capital, with property, with interests. We see this in the political system of the United States, where the Electoral College and the corporations and the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, the CIA, those are the real mechanisms of power in the country, not the average person. At least in other countries around the world, in Venezuela, in Cuba, Nicaragua, Iran, Russia, you have direct democracy. The people directly vote for who they want.
The chaotic withdrawal of U.S. forces was indeed a key factor defining his first year in office. The president ignored the fact that poorly planned withdrawal of U.S. military from Afghanistan would severely hurt his popularity. In the initial days after the full U.S. withdrawal, many Western citizens and allies would be left behind.
The aftermath of the Afghanistan pullout by the United States after 20-year occupation and invasion of Afghanistan is very detrimental to the Democrats, to their image in U.S. politics. I think that moving forward, people are going to advocate for a more interventionist, Zionist, pro-war policy in the Middle East and South Asia. Because, first of all, I just want to say that the aftermath of Afghanistan is not only the fault of the Democrats and Biden. This is a systemic issue. Both the Republicans and the Democrats cheered for the war of Afghanistan, the invasion, even though Afghanistan had nothing to do with the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th.
The U.S. military equipment also fell to the hands of Taliban, which immediately took over the country after deposing the Afghan government. The government in Kabul had enjoyed years of support by the United States, but it was still weak and dysfunctional in the face of Taliban advance.
Israel-backed faction of the Republican Party, as well as the Democrats, are going to use the withdrawal of Afghanistan, the Taliban takeover, as an excuse for permitting more U.S. occupation, more U.S. wars, more U.S. invasion. This is a controlled demolition. We know that as we speak, millions of Afghani people are being starved. Food is not being sent into the country. It's being cut off from international aid, from international support. And so that's one of the issues that is going on, is this is a controlled demolition of Afghanistan so that the neocon Israel-backed establishment can go and say, this is why we need the U.S. presence. This is why we need U.S. wars, troops, invasion.
Biden's effort to bring about a new tax and spending proposal initiative revealed how the Democrats were not in the same boat despite having power in the White House, the Senate, and the House when it came to actual policymaking.
I think the tax and spend proposal has been eye-opening for a lot of Democrats. The thing to understand is that the social spending in the proposals were extremely popular amongst the base of the Democratic Party because the United States has been very poor for so many years in having any social program. The U.S. has been dismantling any social programs that help the poor, that help the working class, and help the middle class. And a lot of Democrats saw some of the things in there as a change of direction.
From the radical left to the more moderate liberals and those under the influence of big corporate lobbyists, disagreements abound, revealing the president's faulty leadership. So the question is, does Joe Biden still enjoy support from the Democratic Party? That is the idea projected in the national polls.
Joe Biden has lost the trust of a lot of the people in his party. And talking to people on the street day to day, they're angry, they've lost this trust, and they don't feel as though he's there to push through the promises that he made on the campaign. So the tax and spend, the fact of the matter is those proposals appear as though they were had been previously negotiated, and that basically we were looking at kind of a kabuki theater. They were putting forth popular proposals with the appearance that some of them would get through, and they were all wiped out. I think it was very tactically, it was a tremendous error for the Biden administration to do that, because they've now lost the support of a significant portion of their party.
The Biden administration has effectively failed in de-escalation of tensions with other superpowers, namely China and Russia. In the previous administration, Moscow was having better ties with Washington, at least on the surface.
Well, I felt that under the Trump administration, the foreign policy was, of course, very aggressive, and as usual, they had poor relations with Russia and China. However, the Biden administration, they did not promise that they would improve the relationship with Russia and China, and in fact, I think they implied that they would make relationship with Russia worse. But they've made the Russia and the relationship with both countries significantly worse. Additionally, keep in mind that another part of the foreign policy argument of the Biden campaign was that they would improve relationships with their allies. If an empire can actually have allies, I would argue the empire only has hangers-on and vassals.
With Biden in office, the U.S. aggression and rivalry has continued unabated towards Beijing, both in the South China Sea and in competitive sectors such as tech and cybersecurity. The U.S. penchant for hegemony and monopoly in the military and commercial system is indeed nothing new and continues without much control of the president in the capitalist system. Where is the status of tensions with China and Russia nearly a year into the Biden administration compared to the previous one?
All misconceptions that the Democrats are a peace-loving party, that the Democrats are a progressive or anti-war party. The U.S. is still ramping up its war against Russia and China. Obviously, the Republicans have been more focused on China. Trump's government has talked badly about China in many ways, has even tried to blame COVID-19 on China. And that's sort of the faction that's backing Trump and the Republicans, is the anti-China crowd. The Democrats, on the other hand, hate Russia. They say Putin is a dictator. They say that Russia is invading other countries. They're trying to stoke tensions with Russia through Ukraine, as we're seeing happening right now. The liberals and the Democrats support Ukraine, the neoliberal fascist government that's in Ukraine against Russia, and they supported the 2014 Euromaidan, a violent fascist coup in Ukraine against the democratically elected government.
The coronavirus pandemic was another instance of poor leadership by Joe Biden and his team. Of course, the number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths dropped after the introduction of vaccines, but the lack of trust in the government led to a boost in movements such as that of the anti-vaxxers.
Joe Biden has leaned on vaccinations, really. That's been the heart of his policy, and I haven't seen much else. It's basically, we have to get everyone vaccinated, and they're using a heavy-handed approach in that you must be vaccinated or you will face a heavy price. You can lose your job, you can't go in and out of stores. So he has been heavy-handed and really authoritarian in his policies to address the pandemic, and he's used the vaccination process as the heart and soul of his policy, and it just hasn't gotten the job done. And if the vaccination process does not fix things, which it certainly doesn't appear as it will, then I don't know where the Biden administration goes from there.
So American vaccines such as Pfizer were repeatedly called into question. Leftist media tried its best to promote vaccines as critical, and the right-wing ones attempted to question their functionality, which led to a divide on a fairly new topic during the pandemic. So how do you think the U.S. president has handled the pandemic, and what are the pros and cons of his policies, and do you think he has managed to keep his promises?
Joe Biden has handled the pandemic in a really superficial and fake way. What do I mean by that? I mean that he brands himself as somebody who took an opposite approach to Trump. Trump's approach to fixing the issues created by COVID-19, Trump was somebody who advocated the free market, less regulation, no COVID tests, no safety protocols, which is dangerous. We know that this is a very dangerous virus. We know that certain precautions have to be taken, regulations to protect people's health, right? That's one hand. So on the opposite side of that, Biden is somebody who's saying we need over-regulation, we need to shut everything down, mandate the vaccine.
Biden inherited an extremely divided nation after the 2020 presidential election. But as Trump never conceded to him, his supporters still do not consider Biden as the president. Trump is aggressively moving towards shifting power in the swing states.
Biden certainly inherited a divided country. I think one thing that is important to mention is that the United States is not a nation in the way that Iran is a nation. The United States is not a nation in the way that Cuba is a nation. It's not a nation in the way that Korea is a nation. The United States is a financial empire built on the oppression and enslavement of Africans who were enslaved, kidnapped, and brought over to the United States to perform slave labor for white slave masters based on the genocide of indigenous peoples, indigenous nations, whose land was robbed and stolen.
Trump could repeat allegations of fraud in the next presidential election, but this time with more serious consequences than the January 6th storming of the Capitol by his supporters. Biden has been criticized for lack of tangible measures to prevent Trump from pursuing his agenda, which could send the fate of the next presidential election into U.S. court and street battles for years.
The history of the United States is not one of a nation, but of an empire, a corporation. The United States is the first corporation, United States of America, incorporated. And it has branded itself as a united nation, everyone's equal, everyone's together. But in reality, it was never really like that.
And Joe Biden's return to power this time as the president was indeed an end to the so-called bipartisanship in America. He had vowed to bring unity to the ever-widening gap in American policies, but he has obviously failed.
People see that Biden is somebody who is duly elected, not very popular. I think he has one of the lowest approval ratings ever in U.S. history. And yet, he's not even making decisions for himself. In his speeches and press conferences, he says, I have to do this or else I'll get in trouble. Who is he reporting to? Who's controlling what he's doing and saying?
The Republican politicians are using all their power to disrupt his plans rather than focusing on their constituents' demands. Top GOP figures, such as Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, are refusing to cooperate with the aged politician to make sure they still have a place in the Trump camp.
And it seems that with Biden, he's not in control. Half the time, he doesn't even know where he is. And it's sad to see that because we have somebody in power in office who doesn't really care about the interests of the average person. He's carrying out the actions of dark corporate interests of the military-industrial complex like a puppet, the way a puppet would operate. And I think the illusion of democracy in the U.S. is definitely falling. I think people recognize that corporations are the real levers of power in the country, the industrial complexes. And I think this is why we're seeing rampant polarization, both on the left and the right. People are becoming either white supremacist militias in the countryside, or they're joining protests, they're anti-capitalist, they're anti-imperialist, and we're seeing these divisions grow bigger every day.
Democracy in America is indeed in a dangerous situation and ever more dysfunctional. After 4 years in office, Trump believes he has learned how to manipulate the system and gain advantage of it in order to return to power.
Now, certain states such as Arizona, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Wisconsin play a key factor in the American election game, and Donald Trump is fully aware of that. Joe Biden appears to be failing in putting an end to corruption in the U.S. political system by what many feel is nothing more than wishful thinking.
People who run the country are the people with the most power, because it is based, again, on this demonic, diabolical understanding, worshiping of power, of strength, not on human compassion, not on greed, human solidarity, but on greed. And the United States has never been a democracy, but the illusion of quote-unquote American democracy is also withering away, because people see that even though Biden was allegedly elected to become president, which is also a claim that many people have disputed, a lot of people know how, as much as I disagree with Donald Trump, you have to admit that he has a strong following and base in the United States.
The races for a takeover of power have already started in the United States. With the 2022 midterms nearing, the Republicans are doing all they can to make sure Trump's power is consolidated in key states.
Really, what's coming to the fore is this decaying empire that has branded itself as a nation, but really wasn't at its inception. And we're seeing this unfold, and I think eventually we're going to get to the point where the U.S., as the empire that it was formed, is going to begin to split off and to decay, to rupture, because this is fundamental to its origins as a slave empire, as a settler colonial project, much in the same way, for example, as the quote-unquote state of Israel. Israel claims to be a nation. Israel claims to be a separate identity, as historic land. But we know that it's a banking project instituted by specific families, by specific banking financial.
The Biden team has to be watchful of the race county by county. Otherwise, it will affect a second term by Barack Obama's former vice president or another one of the Democratic nominees for the next presidential race. Republicans are most probably poised for wins in the upcoming election, and there seems to be nothing the U.S. president can do about it.
One of the most prevalent ways of voting in the United States is using these electronic voting machines. And in many of states, the voting machines have no paper ballot, have no way of tracing whether or not the final count is accurate. So a million people can vote, and we simply have to take the words of our leaders. We have to accept their assertions that the machines weren't hacked, weren't changed. There is significant data out to show that these machines are easily hackable. So we have to believe that our intelligence agencies, some of the most nefarious intelligence agencies on earth that spend their day and night planning how to overthrow governments and undermine elections around the world, we have to believe that they would not overthrow, undermine the elections in the United States.
Biden's legacy and that of the Democrats is in peril some half a decade after a barrage of criticism directed towards Trump. The billionaire businessman's rise to power brought forward unprecedented consequences and appear to be here to stay.
We're seeing rampant poverty, Black, Indigenous, Latino immigrants in the United States. We're seeing decaying infrastructure. We're seeing divisions, polarization. People are politically polarized. You either have people on the extreme right wing, white supremacists, white nationalists, who want to talk about taking our country back, forming white militias that are shooting down immigrants at the borders. And then you have people in the United States who are migrants, who maybe are not even able to speak English, who are looking for work.
Joe Biden's traditional statesmanship was deemed to be a game changer at first, yet now many on the left believe that it is not going to last the aggressive Trump agenda. Well, anyway, everyone, thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure you tune in next week when we're back with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Climate groups are demanding world leaders urgently change course by rejecting false solutions and committing to stop greenhouse gas emissions at a source to have any chance of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanus, a journalist. This article is published under the heading, More Than Halfway Through COP26, World Leaders Accused of Delivering Empty Promises on a Sinking Ship. Stay tuned for more. With just days left of the United Nations Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland, climate groups are demanding world leaders urgently change course by rejecting false solutions and committing to stop greenhouse gas emissions at a source to have any chance of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Glasgow-based climate activist Francis Brewer in a statement said, "On the proverbial sinking boat of the climate crisis, the water's up to our feet, but we still have the chance to keep afloat. Our leaders must do whatever it takes to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius," he continued. "This means strong commitments and just actions today." Brewer's call came alongside a creative action pushing leaders to raise climate ambition at COP26. Art installation in the Forth and Clyde Canal in Glasgow featured activists dressed as world leaders negotiating on a replica UN negotiation stage meant to look as if it's sinking in rising waters. The politicians, including a fake US President Joe Biden, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, sat behind a banner that read, "World Leaders, Last Call for Climate Action," and depicted an earth dripping in oil. The activists say that thus far at COP26, little has emerged to evoke optimism. To wit, an analysis published recently of summit attendees by a Global Witness-led coalition found that fossil fuel industry representatives have a larger presence at the event than officials from any single country. Also this week, the first draft of the final decision text of the summit emerged and does not mention phasing out fossil fuels. In a newsletter recently, Extinction Rebellion took stock of progress at a conference. So far, the group wrote, this conference has not been the climate game changer promised by politicians and promoted by the media. It's true that multiple global pledges have emerged. Yet, said Extinction Rebellion, none are legally binding, few have stood up to scrutiny, and many offer so much wiggle room as to be meaningless. The group further noted that COP26 is occurring in a backdrop of global carbon emissions rising again after a short pandemic-triggered decline. "We are not heading towards a brave new world," the group lamented, "just using a small print and tech fixes to hold onto the old use." Among the false solutions climate groups say are being peddled at the conference is carbon markets, a scheme grassroots Global Justice Alliance spanned as a carbon unicorn that amounts to smoke and mirrors to avoid really keeping fossil fuels in the ground. The agitation from grassroots groups for leaders to commit to bolder climate action comes as the Climate Action Tracker, CAT, released its latest update, projecting that based on government's 2030 pledges alone, the global temperature increase will be at 2.4 degrees Celsius in 2100. Greenpeace International Executive Director Jennifer Morgan compared the projection to a telescope trained on an asteroid heading for Earth, adding that CAT delivered a devastating report that in any sane world would cause governments in Glasgow to immediately set aside their differences and work with uncompromising vigor for a deal to save our common future. We have until the weekend to turn this thing around, Morgan said in her statement, adding that means countries agreeing how they are going to come back next year and every year after that until the gap of 1.5 degrees Celsius is closed. No more excuses, she said. It's up. Our leaders need to deliver, and now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Scores of surveillance bunkers, checkpoints and frequent frisking of residents and vehicles have made life difficult in Indian-administered Kashmir. Following the deadly October violence in and around Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi has tightened security in the region. More than 20,000 paramilitary forces, CRPF and some 5,000 border security forces, BSF, have been called into action. The paramilitaries have occupied locations in the residential areas, a move that has raised concerns among the residents.
It's a serious life threat to all of us. The entire neighborhood will collapse if any sort of unexpected incident happens.
Authorities say these measures are taken to avoid further civilian deaths.
Forces have been in Kashmir since 1947. The only reason to call the additional forces sometimes is to make Kashmir secure for its residents. Bunkers are constructed against potential terrorist acts. Last month, around a dozen civilians were killed. The presence of forces will therefore ensure a sense of security among the residents.
However, residents complain about the humiliating and disrespectful behavior of the security forces.
Authorities should accommodate or relocate the entire neighborhood. The presence of troops around our homes has made us gripped. Not only this, the usual frisking on roads is also disturbing our mental peace, and we are often being humiliated. The entire population is looked at through the prism of terrorism and terrorists.
Kashmir is the world's largest militarized zone and the longest pending dispute. India and Pakistan have fought wars over the territory since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. The two countries rule the region in parts but claim it in full.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi promised equality to the people of Kashmir. Analysts say 2 years on, people of Kashmir have instead developed a deeper sense of insecurity and alienation. And so far, New Delhi has done least to address their grievances. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
And
Another moment of pride for Iran at the United Nations for its active partnership since joining the world body in 1950. The country has now become a full member of the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Iran's accession was approved by a unanimous vote at the Special Political Committee of the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. UNSCEAR rarely expanded to include new members, but under the resolution proposed by Australia, four countries were admitted, raising the number to 31. Norway, Algeria, and the UAE were other nations who joined the body. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht Ravanchi, praised the General Assembly's decision to admit Iran into the committee. He expressed Tehran's full support for the body in its scientific endeavors to protect the planet and humans.
Iran reiterates its full support for and cooperation with the UNSCE in order to further enhance the infrastructure capacity and training of its personnel, as well as support nuclear safety, protect the public health and the environment from the harmful effects of atomic radiation.
Iran's accession is perceived as a major step forward since the top UN scientific body on nuclear safety has always been under Western influence. As expected, the decision faced stiff opposition from Israel and the U.S. Takht Ravanchi responded to anti-Iran allegations raised by Israel and the U.S. He said the track record of Tel Aviv and Washington show they are not in a position to oppose Iran's membership to the scientific committee. The Iranian envoy said that while the Israeli regime has flagrantly violated many UN resolutions and defied international efforts to contain weapons of mass destruction, Washington dishonored its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. A nuclear scientist has hailed Iran's accession to the committee as a very positive step.
In general, it's a good move for Iran. Iran can have send some of its scientists to the mission to join the work and the effort of this committee. I think at the end it will be a very positive step for Iran.
As Afghans witnessed their most difficult days, the 12th round of Iranian aid to Afghanistan arrived in Kabul. These batches, including 5 tons of medicines and 5 tons of food, are meant to treat injuries and be distributed to the families of victims of Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Daoud Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Iran's been sending a series of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan since the beginning of the recent crisis in the country, at the recommendation of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to help our brothers. This current shipment will target those who were injured and lost their beloved ones in the recent Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Daoud Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Taliban officials welcome emergency aid to the country and thank those who stay by the Afghan side in the darkest days. People suffering from poverty and difficulties await more help from the world countries.
We thank Iran for its humanitarian aid to our people. May God give them in return. Iranian aids have always been on time, especially when they helped us with emergency aid after 2 large mosque blasts. Today, our people in a critical situation and need help. So the world countries should help us and free our frozen assets.
The recent crisis largely affected our poor people. We don't have anything to eat or treat our patients. My brother is injured. Now he is under treatment here. Neither the hospital has enough medicines, nor do we have enough money to buy them from outside.
At least 25 people were killed and more than 50 wounded when Daesh terrorist gunmen attacked the 400-bed Sardar Mohammad Daoud Khan Hospital after 2 heavy explosions at the site in central Kabul. Daesh attacks come as hunger crises are looming in the country. Some countries, including Iran, have been sending shipments of aid. However, to address the problem of hunger in Afghanistan, more international assistance is needed. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Furious students gathered outside the London School of Economics on Tuesday to condemn the university after its debate society invited Israel's UK ambassador to speak at an evening event. The university claimed the event is meant to encourage discourse about the Middle East, but a large number of Muslim and pro-Palestine students are having none of it.
These students are not just angry at the fact that the Israeli ambassador is speaking here today, but they're also venting their frustrations at the university and the debate society as well. They say that by inviting the ambassador to speak here today, they've essentially platformed racism and Islamophobia.
Appointed in 2020, Israel's Tzipi Hotovely has been condemned over past comments she made targeting Arabs and Islam. She once reportedly denied Palestine's existence and famously said the Nakba was a great Arab lie.
This is against what the student body wanted. For this university, all the students here are deeply ashamed. This university has failed to recognize and represent the student body.
Someone like this person doesn't really deserve the right to speak about them. She has made comments dehumanizing an entire people. If she can dehumanize people and invalidate their right to speak, why should she have any sort of right?
So she's actually a preacher, a hate preacher, legitimizing killing children, legitimizing destroying Palestinian hope, legitimizing the expansion of settlers, brutally destroying the crops and everything of the Palestinian.
We as a Jews, we feel obliged to stand up against this racist, against this fascist, and what she presents and who she presents. And we want to encourage the students to come out again in the open for justice, for peace.
Despite the backlash and a walkout staged by students inside the debate hall, the talk went ahead. The Palestinian ambassador will also speak, but at a separate event on the 11th of November. But that hasn't been enough to calm the students' anger. Robert Carter, London.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment and custodial torture continue with impunity, while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Major problem is Pakistan.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over 7 decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Senior military commanders parade and salute army soldiers as the last phase of a 3-day maneuver codenamed Zulfaqar 1400. The military exercise engaged the 4 branches of the Iranian army and was held over a 1 million square kilometer area, stretching from the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Army commanders say the drill was a success and it carries regional and global messages.
The Islamic Republic has in recent years proved that it can be the axis of regional security, which entails a collective regional cooperation. If regional states join hands, they can protect the security of the region without the need to rely on foreigners. History has shown that foreign countries would never bring sustainable security to any nation.
The massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems. The Army also deployed its latest combat and reconnaissance drones, which are produced domestically. The Islamic Republic takes great pride in indigenizing its defense arsenal against the backdrop of an all-out sanctions regime by the U.S. that blocks Iran's access to even a bullet from other countries.
The Iranian army is prepared to confront any force that could possibly threaten Iran's territorial integrity and interests. Using our indigenous defense equipment, we are capable of defending our soil and will nip in the bud any threat from our enemies.
Situated in a geopolitically sensitive region, Iran holds regular drills as a means to enhance its preparedness in the face of possible threats, such as terrorism and piracy. Iran's armed forces have on different occasions underscored that the country will not be the first to pull the trigger, and its military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression.
The three-day military exercise wrapped up with important messages. On top of them is that Iran is strongly opposed to any foreign presence in the regional waters, describing it as destabilizing and provocative. The Iranian army says Iran and other regional countries are the ones that are responsible for ensuring the security of the region. And this means extraterritorial forces must go home. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
The ongoing Saudi-imposed war has put a further strain on the already fragmented education system of Yemen. In a recent report, UNICEF said more than 2 million Yemeni children remain out of school, as nearly three-quarters of public school teachers in several governorates have not been paid for over two school years.
Since the first moment of the Saudi-led war, the educational process has been directly targeted, whether by air raids that targeted schools and their surroundings, or by depriving teachers of their due salaries. Also, a large number of schools were converted into shelters for the displaced, and some schools were closed because they are located on the front lines of the military battles. All these factors have caused a low level of education for Yemeni children.
The report added that an estimated 1.7 million children are internally displaced and more than 8 million children do not have access to safe water, sanitation or hygiene, which contributes to a growing number of children suffering from acute malnutrition and infectious diseases such as cholera.
It is clear that targeting the educational process is a priority for the Saudi-led coalition, and for this reason, over 7 years, we have suffered a lot. And what helped us is the sense of responsibility on the part of teachers and parents. UN statistics say 2 million children do not have access to education, and 8 million children do not get their most basic needs, and this is a real catastrophe.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in March 2015, the kingdom has bombed over 1,100 schools and 180 universities in a clear violation of the international humanitarian law that protects educational facilities as civilian objects.
As the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate in Yemen due to the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade, children continue to be the ones who pay the heaviest price. UNICEF describes Yemen as the most dangerous place on earth for children to grow up. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Europe is divided over how to deal with the mounting humanitarian crisis on its borders. Some are calling for walls and barbed wire. Asylum seekers are being used as pawns in political disputes, and desperate people mercilessly pushed back and forth between borders, left to die in the space between with no food or shelter. The UN has called foul, but it seems no one is listening.
Yet the European Union's 28 members seem to be absolutely abysmally hopeless in organizing any kind of real strategy around migrants and their facilitation.